From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, a tax compromise on the fiscal cliff, high drama in Congress, and Hillary Clinton to the hospital. There were midnight votes and higher taxes for the highest earners. The president celebrated.
A central premise of my campaign for president was to change the tax code that was too skewed towards the wealthy at the expense of working middle-class Americans. Tonight, we've done that.
There was fury from Republicans toward Republicans as Congress put off voting on Hurricane Sandy relief. Here's New Jersey Governor Chris Christie.
There's only one group to blame for the continued suffering of these innocent victims, the House majority and their Speaker, John Boehner.
And a battered John Boehner won re-election as Speaker of the House. He called for less grandstanding and more action.
Put simply, we're sent here not to be something, but to do something. Or as I like to call it, doing the right thing.
This hour on Point, our first weekly roundtable of 2013 with Annie Lowry of the New York Times, Robert Costa of National Review, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. With us this hour from Washington is Annie Lowry, economic policy reporter for the New York Times. Annie, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. Also with us from Washington, Robert Costa, Washington editor for National Review. Robert, welcome. Wonderful to have you.
Oh, it's great to join you.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Annie, and Robert.
Happy New Year, everybody. Everybody's wondering what we just saw here and what's still to come. Let's hear first from Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. Negotiated the fiscal cliff deal with Vice President Joe Biden. On Tuesday, he said it wasn't perfect, but it was necessary.
This shouldn't be the model for how we do things around here, but I think we can say we've done some good for the country. We've done some good for the country. We've taken care of the revenue side of this debate. And now it's time to get serious about reducing Washington's out-of-control spending. That's a debate the American people want. It's the debate we'll have next, and it's a debate Republicans are ready for.
So more cliffs to come. Annie, the Washington Post editorial headline is "No Way to Run a Country." What have we learned from the way this chapter of the fiscal cliff crisis played out?
Well, I think that what we've learned is that there was this hope for a grand bargain, was what they were calling it, that you would get over the long term something like $4 trillion in deficit reduction. And that didn't really happen. And what it's kind of proven is that Congress is going to have to come back to the well a number of times before they solve the long term debt problem. We still probably need some tax increases, at least groups like the IMF think that we do. And we still need to cut entitlement spending, especially long-term health spending. We haven't solved those problems. The cliff was really, what they managed to do was just get us over the cliff. They didn't really tackle any of the long-term issues. And President Obama said that in his press conference and said that they're going to go through a number of rounds of these. It's probably going to take years before they actually kind of tackle the big stuff.
Robert Costa, what about the Washington Post headline, "No Way to Run a Country"? I mean, what is driving this last-minute sort of legislation by crisis, economy held hostage dynamic here? Is this the way it's going to be again and again in the next weeks and months?
Well, I cover Capitol Hill, and I'm just fascinated at how much personal relationships and personal animosity seems to drive a lot of these stalled talks. You had in the Senate, for example, Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, who we just heard from. Mm-hmm. He has a great relationship with Vice President Biden, and when talks broke down between him and Majority Leader Harry Reid, he reached out to Biden to try to cut a deal. But at the same time, the president's talks were falling apart with Speaker John Boehner. Harry Reid was AWOL in all of the discussions. So it's just fascinating to me that it was only because McConnell called Biden did we see any kind of resolution.
Jack, what do you think? Personality trials here, or, I mean, Paul Krugman writes today, we've got a, you know, down-to-the-bone fundamental battle in this country about what kind of nation we're going to be.
Well, we certainly have that, but we also have a system capable of compromise. I mean, that's what I'm struck with. The Republican, you know, nearly all Republicans in the Senate voted to increase the tax rate on people earning more than $400,000. That was really a significant step, and they did it for also whatever reason that happened. In the House, you got what, 80 votes from Republicans for the same thing, and Democrats had to give on their their side, give on the estate tax. They had to moderate their demands on other matters. So I it happened late. It was messy, but there was compromise. And in Mitch McConnell, you see a kind of Henry Clay figure. You know, he's from Kentucky. He reads a lot about Clay, and like Henry Clay, he brought together a big compromise that satisfied no one, but that's the nature of these things. So in a strange way, I think the system did work.
A compromise, but also a battle that is not over. I want to look a little bit at the win-loss columns there. There were Democrats who were not happy, who wanted Texas to go up on households over 250, not 450. Senator Tom Harkin of Iowa was one of those. He was on the Senate floor on Tuesday saying that it should start lower, that he didn't know a lot of people who made 450 and up. Here's Harkin.
So I am disappointed to say that, in my opinion, this legislation that we're about to vote on falls short. First, it does not address the number one priority, creating good middle-class jobs now.
More revenue, please, says Democratic Senator Tom Harkin of Iowa. Here's Representative David Rivera, Republican of Florida. He voted against the deal on Tuesday night. Wednesday, on the House floor, he said lawmakers had not faced the central issue.
Last evening's vote regarding the so-called fiscal cliff is yet another example of Washington's willingness to forego making difficult long-term decisions regarding spending in deference to short-term fixes that do not solve our looming debt crisis. And that same debt crisis, that is the real fiscal cliff that our nation faces. Because whether we realize it or not, the more our nation climbs this mountain of debt, a mountain we ourselves are creating, the higher the cliffs will be.
Annie Lowrey, help us look within each party here then. I mean, who won here, if we can say one? I mean, it's really the country's future we're talking about. But what about the dissension within the Democratic ranks over this higher number, the compromise the president made here, within Republican ranks over, you know, peeling taxes off and putting spending for later consideration?
Well, I think it kind of gets to the heart of the issue, which is that this is going to be the first vote, presumably of many, where the options on the table are going to be raising taxes and cutting benefits that people really love. This is going to be an excruciatingly painful process, I think. Mm. And so, I think that both sides feel like they lost, and that's probably going to happen over and over and over again a little bit in the coming years, right? Democrats feel like in order to have the sort of safety net that they want and the social spending that they want, they're going to need a lot more tax revenue, and probably you're not going to even have to go down to 250. You're probably going to have to go lower. You're probably going to have to hit some middle class families too. And I think it's important to note that they raised a lot of money, but realistically, if we had an auditorium of taxpayers and there were 1,000 of them, only 7 of them saw a tax increase from this deal. It's really small, proportionately. And you know, on the Republican side, I think that they had wanted to have the tax increases matched with cuts, and that didn't happen. I mean, Democrats would argue that they also wanted some short-term spending measures. I think that everybody is disappointed. I think that is the nature of these things going forward. And I think it's actually kind of hard to say who this is a better deal for. The important thing is that they managed to keep taxes from going up on everybody, which would have been really, really bad for the economy in the short term and wouldn't have helped you in the long term either, right? If the economy is growing slowly,
right,
the problem is that much harder to surmount.
Robert Costa, all kinds of analysis here. BuzzFeed talks about the Democrats' coming civil war. When entitlements get on the table, no consensus in the Democratic Party about how to deal with that. On the other hand, National Journal here describing the Republicans. House Republicans saw the worst of all worlds, the journal says. They failed to save tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans, put no new checks on government spending, showed themselves a fractious and disorganized opposition party. So where are the deepest fissures here, Robert?
There are fissures everywhere right now within the Republican Party, but especially on Capitol Hill. Republicans entered this fiscal cliff fight prepared to block any kind of tax rate increases. We heard all about Grover Norquist, the president of Americans for Tax Reform, and how Republicans would resist any kind of tax increases. But of course, as Annie said, at the end of the day, they had to give up on that pledge. They had to agree to some rate increases. But what we really saw in the last few days is Republicans arguing amongst themselves, not sure of where they can go forward as the debt ceiling approaches, as other fiscal issues pop up throughout 2013. Because Annie mentioned some big issues that are ahead on entitlements, on spending, on taxes. And there's just no strategy and really no leadership right now from Republicans at Capitol Hill. There's no consensus about how to handle this situation. Republicans, I think, are still getting over the election. They're very devastated about Mitt Romney's loss, that they only control the House, that they even lost some seats in the House. And as we saw in the election for Speaker John Boehner, where 12 different Republicans didn't vote for the Speaker, that there's really some fractures, there's some tension, and at this point, I'm not so sure where they're going to go.
Jack Beatty, we'll look at President Obama, we'll look at John Boehner, but just party-wide, each party, where do you see the leverage now after this big chapter in this ongoing drama?
Well, the Republicans think they have it, and they have it with the sequester coming up, and they have it with the debt ceiling. If they're willing once more to essentially hold the economy hostage and say, we will risk the credit rating of the United States in order to get our priorities met. You know, the last debt ceiling debate in 2011, that cost over a decade $18 billion in higher interest rates.
Wow.
That is payments for the taxpayer. That's just to the taxpayer. Leave out what it costs the economy. So this isn't a free exercise, and as people are saying, it is unprecedented. It has never been used in this way before.
We'll come back and look at Boehner, Obama, and much more. Jack Beatty, please stand by. Annie Lowry with the New York Times, Robert Costa with National Review. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, a fiscal cliff deal, sort of. Boehner's back as Speaker of the House. Uproar over Sandy relief. Newtown kids go back to school this week. Happy New Year. It's 2013. Robert Costa is with us from National Review, Washington editor there. Annie Lowry, economic policy reporter for the New York Times, is here. And our own Jack Beatty. Let's look at a couple of big players here, if we can. First, John Boehner, narrowly reelected Speaker of the House. Yesterday, here he was addressing the House after that vote.
Our government has built up too much debt. Our economy is not producing enough jobs. And these are not separate problems. At $16 trillion and rising, our national debt is draining free enterprise and weakening the ship of state.
These are not separate problems, said the Speaker. Robert Costa, on the other hand, he's still the Speaker, and there were moments where that was not clear that it was going to be the future, I guess. Where does John Boehner stand with the House and his party after this week, Robert?
What a scene. What a story. I was inside of the House chamber yesterday, leaning over the railing. I felt like, as a political junkie, I was at the Game 7 of the Political World Series. And there was so much tension on the Republican side of the floor. Boehner was safely reelected on paper with 220 votes yesterday. But what was really more interesting was that at one point, he almost lacked an absolute majority. 17 Republicans at one point during the roll call were about to move against the Speaker. And if Boehner lost 17 Republicans, that meant he lacked the votes to have the absolute majority, and the vote would have went to a second ballot. Now, it never went to a second ballot, but it got really distressingly close to a second ballot. And though Eric Cantor, the majority leader, and Kevin McCarthy, the whip, Paul Ryan, the former vice presidential candidate, they all backed Boehner. There was a group of rabble-rousers, backbenchers, conservatives such as Tim Huelskamp of Kansas, Jim Jordan of Ohio. He voted for Boehner, but he was part of the effort. And a lot of libertarians such as Walter Jones of North Carolina, Justin Amash of Michigan, who's now a sophomore and a rising Ron Paul type in the House, they revolted. But the most important part of the revolt was that it wasn't really organized. It was poorly organized. There was no consensus candidate. You had a wide array of figures nominated by these revolting congressmen. And so the rebellion was quashed, but it says a lot about Boehner's weakened power.
What about his style? I mean, he seems like a deal maker, but he's got a bunch of people in his party who don't want to be deal makers here, think that's the wrong way to go. What about his effectiveness going forward with this House, Robert?
That's a great question. I think his effectiveness as a deal maker is probably finished. To get the votes, to get to 220 votes yesterday on the House floor, John Boehner had to make a lot of behind-the-scenes concessions to conservatives who have been increasingly frustrated with him over the past year. And one of the things that frustrates conservatives in the House very much is how Boehner has been going to the White House week after week during this fiscal cliff debate, huddling with the president, having private negotiations. And the House conservatives who are against Boehner, They've mounted a rebellion because they are sick and tired of these behind-the-scenes negotiations. So what Boehner did at a caucus meeting on Wednesday is he went before the entire House Republican conference and he said, no more negotiations behind the scenes with the president, no more private White House meetings. And he got applause for that, and that won him some votes to secure his speakership. But moving ahead, if Boehner can't negotiate with the president in private and he has to do everything on the House floor, that probably bodes very poorly for any kind of grand bargain or any kind of deal.
Let's look at the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue. President Obama on Tuesday night, after the fiscal cliff deal passed, was through both houses, the president tried to draw a hard line in the sand on using the debt ceiling, which is coming right up here into February, into March, as a negotiating tool. Here's the president that night.
While I will negotiate over many things, I will not have another debate with this Congress over whether or not they should pay the bills that they've already racked up through the laws that they passed. Let me repeat. We can't not pay bills that we've already incurred. If Congress refuses to give the United States government the ability to pay these bills on time, the consequences for the entire global economy would be catastrophic.
Annie Lowrey, there's the president trying to draw a hard line in the sand, but we've got lots of listeners on all sides here. Sort of looks like a Democratic listener here saying the cliff deal was another Obama disappointment, if you ask me. I would love to get him at a poker table. I think he plays even worse than me, writes one of our listeners online. What about how the president played this, what he's given away, where his leverage stands, Annie?
Well, I think that the debt ceiling is going to be a really interesting test. So Republicans have said very openly that they think that the debt ceiling is another opportunity. It's another kind of lever for them to pull to talk about entitlement spending and to try and get some cuts. And so last year, Speaker Boehner created something that was sort of colloquially called the Boehner rule, where for every dollar increase in the debt ceiling, he was going to demand a dollar of cuts. And that kind of didn't come to fruition. They ended up raising the debt ceiling with less. But anyway, moving forward in time, he said the same thing. But President Obama came out this week and said that for every dollar in cuts, he wants a dollar in tax increases.
Right, right.
And so obviously, those two things are not going to work out. This is all going to come to a head at the debt ceiling. And so as of about February 14th or 15th, we don't know exactly when, sometime the end of February, beginning of March, Congress is going to have to raise it. And President Obama has basically said, Congress, you're going to have to do this yourself. I'm not negotiating with you. And so some people thought that that meant he might mount some kind of legal challenge to the debt ceiling. It turns out that what he meant was that he's literally not going to negotiate. And I've talked with some people in the White House about this, and they're like, well, you know, we're not going to pick up the phone. We're just not going to talk about it. And so
they can drive
over
the cliff or not as they like. It's up to them. Is that really what they're going to just sit there?
I think that Democrats are concerned that Obama has put a lot of really bright lines down and then been perfectly happy to negotiate on them. And it seems that, you know, simply not talking about the debt ceiling is not going to be a negotiating strategy that he's going to be able to hold. Nobody knows how this is going to play out. It's going to be this huge test. And I think going back to Robert's really astute political analysis, it comes back to whether John Boehner is going to be willing to negotiate on this too, and how he's being pulled by his party, which I think, you know, as Robert pointed out, is really ideological. Ideologically diverse is probably one way to put it. Republicans have very different aims and goals, and there isn't a lot of unity there. And I think that a lot of people will demand that they don't raise the ceiling.
Jack, get in here. What have we learned and what do we see? Boehner won't call the president. The president won't call Capitol Hill. We've got our listeners saying he'd like to play poker with this president. Doesn't look like much of a player to him. What are you seeing, learning here, Jack?
Well, we have a potential constitutional crisis coming up. The president cannot go, you know, if he negotiates on this debt ceiling and concedes to the Republicans, he has forever weakened the office of the presidency. This will happen again and again. On the other hand, if the Congress simply says, well, all right, we'll pass on this, we'll cede to whatever you want to do. At one point, of course, the president said, I want the debt ceiling off the table completely. If they do that, they're giving up the power of the purse. So you have, you know, strong constitutional claims on either side. And, you know, those are the kinds of situations where presidents earn their pay and they're implicitly impeachment situations.
So what about the Constitution of this man then, Jack, the president?
the constitution of the man. Well, I mean, I think that what we're going to see from the president is he's going to try to raise the political price for the Republicans over the next few weeks. I think we're going to have more public events. I think we're going to have more speeches. I think we're going to have more alarm. And by the way, you don't have to be hyperbolic in your alarm about what this could mean. And I think that he's going to try to raise the stakes of what's at stake for the Republicans. Whether that will work is another question. Now, some people are saying, well, the president has no good relationships with the people in Congress. That may be. He does have Joe Biden. He is responsible for Joe Biden. Mm. Joe Biden manages to deal with Mitch McConnell very well. That's an ace in the hole he has. The president doesn't have to do everything. He doesn't have to be, you know, the deal at every level of challenge. It's enough that he has the strategic picture. And here he's in an implicitly constitutional crisis with the Congress.
We're going to look more at that on Monday. Jack, Annie, Robert, please stand by. Let's bring our listeners in. Zeke is calling from Des Moines, Iowa. Zeke, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you, Tom. I appreciate the show. I've called in before. I always enjoy a stimulating conversation.
Great. What do you see?
Great show.
Great.
I have a comment. I hope it doesn't come across as cynical, but I want you to just think about it. And that is this, that people need to realize that the Republicans and some Democrats, let's say the wealthy bunch in Congress, actually can benefit by us going off a fiscal cliff and or a debt ceiling debacle, because you drive up interest rates to the bond market or just any interest rates. And if you're a large holder of cash like they are, some of these businesses, they benefit. They can get more for their money and interest rates. So the greater good of the country is not their concern. I mean, they actually can benefit by an economic calamity for the rest of them.
Zeke, you may be right. I hope you're not. That's about getting about as deeply cynical as it can about public servants. Robert, what do you say? They're looking at interest rates, they got a pile of cash, and so, okay, over we go.
I'm not so sure about that. Maybe some lawmakers have that as part of their thinking, but I doubt it. I think a lot of businesses, at least from what I've heard from Republican lawmakers, were pushing very hard to avert any kind of tax rate increases, to not go over the fiscal cliff. So I'm just not so sure about that point.
Let me get Peter in Stamford, Connecticut. Peter, you're on.
Yes, I want to just give you a picture, like a visual picture. You know the Grand Canyon? Have you ever seen the Grand Canyon?
Yes, I have. Yes, I have, Peter.
Well, there's a cliff we just passed, but this is going to be another cliff and another cliff and another cliff. It's like the Grand Canyon. We get to the edge, and then we're back to the parking lot, back to the viewing area. We'll go about a few more feet, and then there's another wind for another cliff. And what happens if we just go off the cliff? We take our medicine. You know, this is a global problem. Europe has a fiscal cliff, and China is producing...
But what do you mean by that exactly, Peter? Do you mean sort of take the medicine, go for austerity? Is that what you're suggesting?
Exactly. Maybe I'm heretical with this, and maybe I'm the bad person in the room. Maybe I'm the adult in the room. But why don't we go with austerity, and we cut our cable, we do a little more unstimulus, like Social Security just added a couple percentage to of tax to our paychecks this year that was underreported. But, we go for austerity. I know
Peter, let us pick it up right there. Annie Lowrey, come in here. You're the economic policy reporter. How about it? We turn off the lights, turn down the heat, eat the oatmeal, take the austerity. You know, there are people who look at that pile of debt and say, let's just bite the bullet. How's that work? What do you say, Annie?
Well, we could have done that, right? At the fiscal cliff, we could have let all of the tax increases come into place, and we could have let the sequester go. That's, you know, $1 trillion
spending
of spending.
Cuts, yep.
And that would have fixed the problem far faster than anybody in Congress wanted to fix the problem, right? They averted that. They chose not to do that. And the reason is that you would really hurt low-income families. You would really hurt growth. You would probably go back into a recession. And the
opportunity would it then really fix the problem? If you go back into recession, what happens to all your other revenues when it comes to trying to balance the books?
There's a good question, and countries like Spain have had this problem where they keep cutting, and that only makes the recession worse. But then if the recession is worse, you don't have enough tax revenue, so you have to keep on cutting. This kind of vicious cycle. The United States, I think, is in a virtuous growth cycle right now, as long as nothing too disruptive unexpectedly comes up. But I would note that the opportunity has passed. You can't do that with the debt ceiling. If you simply don't raise the debt ceiling, all you get is a huge cash management crisis, a bond market freakout, a stock market freak out. It doesn't do anything good for the actual federal purse. And we don't actually really know what it would look like, because it would just be this completely unprecedented thing. It would be like the mother of all government shutdowns. So they could have done that, but they didn't. And I think it's really important to note that the main thing that they did in January, fixing the fiscal cliff, was they made most of the Bush tax cuts permanent. They're just never going back there. And if they do raise taxes in the future, I think that they're going to do it not by raising rates, but by getting revenue, by closing loopholes, because tax code lets a lot of money go with a bunch of special provisions.
Next time out, no upside here. Joe in Williamsburg, Kentucky. Joe, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. Just wanted to make a comment as a old-time political observer from Kentucky.
Yes, sir.
That we just saw a traditional Kentucky political trick by Mitch McConnell, where you create a problem that only you can solve, and then you solve it, and you turn yourself around in the eyes of the constituents. I'd like to hear your comments on that.
Joe, we'll pick it up. Robert, how about it? Create a problem, solve it, come out a hero. And Joe in Kentucky sees an old familiar move there.
No, it's a great. I think the McConnell story, as this fiscal cliff unfolded, is really a key component. Mitch McConnell, when we heard his comments earlier in the show on the Senate floor, you're just struck. He's so low key. He almost grumbles his words, but he is one of the most powerful figures behind the scenes. And he really took this negotiating process and made it to his advantage. On Sunday night, before the impasse was solved, as Reid did not come back with a counteroffer during their negotiations, he was decided to call Biden, and that was really McConnell taking control of the process. Now, the Reid component was only part of it, though. What McConnell was also doing was asserting himself as the Republican in the negotiations. John Boehner, as Speaker of the House, had failed to pass Plan B, his own alternative to the fiscal cliff, and that severely weakened Boehner's hand. And so into the fray steps McConnell, as ever, it seems, in Washington, and takes the Republican reins.
So here we are, Annie, and now there's more leverage if there's leverage in the debt ceiling itself. But as you say, there's not much upside. If we really go over that, everybody pays the price. So how real do you think that leverage is? Maybe the president can't change the dynamic, but can the GOP really afford to fully play that card? What if he just sits in the White House and says, okay, your turn?
Well, you know, one of the weirdnesses about the debt ceiling is that, you know, sort of actually like with the fiscal cliff negotiations themselves, I actually think that people see a path to compromise. The president has said that he's willing to put what's called chain CPI, which is kind of a change to the Social Security formula that eventually, you know, sucks some money out of that program, on the table. Maybe they're willing to sit down and talk about some other entitlement reforms to Medicare, and doing things like some means testing of other programs in exchange. But the problem is that the president has said that he wants more tax revenue if he's going to do any cutting. That's not going to fly with Republicans so soon after they just very painfully passed this tax increase. So I don't think that it's clear coming up who's going to blink first, but one of them is going to have to. And I think that it's just one of these things that really nobody knows how this is going to play out, because it could hypothetically be really economically damaging if you got very close to the point that the United States ran out of money to pay all its bills. And you know, when you think about how that would actually play out in the economy, bondholders would probably still get paid. But, you know, do they not pay soldiers salaries? Do they not, you know, make payments to contractors? We just don't know what they would do.
Everybody's talking entitlements, Jack. That means Social Security. That means Medicare. Do you see room in the Democratic Party to talk on that front, or people want to close ranks and say no, nothing?
Well, if they could get a functioning economy, if the Republicans would agree to let the economy and the recovery keep going by not essentially forcing us into the debt crisis, then perhaps it is significant that the president himself has come forward with the Social Security. Earlier, he talked about raising the retirement age on Medicare. Very, very big concession.
So cards on the table there already. Jack, please stand by. Robert Costa and Lowry, we're looking at a week in the news. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, the first week of the year 2013 in India, the victim of a violent gang rape died, sparking more big protests against sexual violence.
We today are fighting for a basic human right, that is the right to security. And it is just not limited to women or one girl. It is for the nation at large.
For the nation at large, the voice from India. Classes resumed for students from Sandy Hook Elementary. Here's Newtown School Superintendent Janet Robinson.
The children are coming in. They are so excited to see their teachers. And the students coming in completes a circle.
And singer Patti Page died at the age of 85. Here's her great 1950 10 million copies sold hit, Tennessee Waltz.
I remember the night and the Tennessee Waltz. Now I know just how much I have lost.
Love that song. We're looking at a week in the news. The first of 2013, a fiscal cliff deal, sort of. Boehner's back, uproar over Sandy relief. Newtown kids go back to school. Annie Lowry, The New York Times, is with us. Robert Costa of National Review and our own Jack Beatty. Robert, I want to get into this Sandy Hook business for the Hurricane Sandy for a minute. Sandy Hook, worse than business, but Hurricane Sandy, bad enough, and people there in a heap of trouble. A lot of money was sitting on the table, folks thought, ready to go to them in relief. Then it did not. And we heard this tremendous outburst of a lot of Republicans saying, what's going on here? This was Wednesday. Republican Representative Peter King expressing his anger at the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, for not introducing that legislation late in the 112th Congress to aid Sandy victims.
Last night, the Speaker of the House of Representatives walked off the floor, didn't even give us the courtesy of a notice. He told an aide to the Majority Leader, who told us, and then we ended up telling the Majority Leader, I believe. So there's some dysfunction in the Republican leadership. The Speaker, for some reason, is taking it out on New York and Long Island and New Jersey, but it's a disgrace.
It's a disgrace. Chris Christie piling on is disgusting. It's a disgrace. The next day, next morning, Thursday, after John Boehner announced the House would be voting on Sandy aid, here's Representative King again, backtracking.
It was a skirmish. It was very important. But as far as I'm concerned, it's over with. John Boehner and I had been friends before. Hopefully we're friends again. We shook hands yesterday. But when it comes to fighting for my constituents, I had an obligation to do it.
It's a disgrace. It's okay. What went on there, Robert?
It's a great, fascinating political story. On Tuesday, when the fiscal cliff deal went through the House, Boehner brought it to the floor, and it was a clean vote. No amendments were allowed. Boehner wanted to get this thing done. He brought it to the floor. This caused an uproar within the House Republican Conference, who wanted to amend it with spending cuts. So once this fiscal cliff deal passes on Tuesday, you have a lot of frustrated Republicans. And one thing they're not eager to do is pass a spending bill. And we can argue this point, but a lot of Republicans consider the Sandy relief package to be a stimulus package, to be full of unnecessary spending as well as some relief. And so what Boehner decided to do was pull it at the last minute on Tuesday night because he didn't want to put it to a vote. He knew his members were very much uneasy about having another vote on spending, and so he didn't do it. And so what Peter King did on Tuesday night is walked up to the press gallery, furious with a lot of other New Yorkers and New Jersey Republicans and Democrats, and started talking to reporters at around midnight about how he was maybe going to leave the party, how this was a disaster, how Boehner had betrayed him. And it was high drama right after the fiscal cliff. And we saw all day Wednesday the New Jersey and New York Republicans arguing on television that Boehner was preventing this relief from getting to the victims of the hurricane. But Boehner, as he often does, soothed the differences. He brought King into his office at 3 p.m. on Wednesday and made sure that he promised to bring it to the floor. So now it's coming to the floor in the House. It's going to come to the floor in the Senate. But it was probably a political play by Boehner that it was just another unnecessary bad headline for the Speaker.
Annie Lowry, you're an economic policy reporter. Something like $60 billion expected now on its way. Does that look like relief to you or stimulus or both?
Yeah, it does look like both. And one other important thing is that in the rebuilding process, interest rates remain really low. The economy is picking up. That's all going to help. And the money should help, too. And I agree that, you know, Republican concerns that the bill was a Trojan horse made it just really hard for the Speaker. And I think, you know, there was a concern that he ended up looking a little bit petty by stalling it. But ultimately, these couple days probably won't matter if it goes through. And, you know, but the damage was really, really significant in Sandy, and the federal dollars will absolutely help.
We've got a call coming. Jack, please, yes.
Well, I was going to say, you could see there an incipient split in the House, in the ranks of the House GOP along geographic lines. And this was coming out, the sense of, well, Northeastern Republicans are expendable. They're not really part of our party. There was some of that feeling.
They're not Tea Party enough.
Not Tea Party enough. And you could also see that in the fiscal cliff vote. 83-10 in the South against it. 83-10 against the Senate bill, and in the North, 24-1 for it. This is Republicans. Now that's a split Maybe the president can get votes there for tax increases later. Who knows? Maybe this is the beginning of a larger division in the Republican ranks. Grover Norquist, after all, with his group, he was on the side of, yes, we'll go up, we'll make the deal. On the other hand, the billionaire funders of Tea Party and Club for Growth, the Koch brothers and others, no, they're against it. So you see a division on geographic lines within the Republican Party.
Oh, but maybe it's just geography. Lord knows there's been enough relief poured into hurricane relief over the decades, you know, in the southern part of this country, Jack. I don't know. Let's get a call from down there. West Palm Beach, Florida. Jim is calling. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I just think this is another example that there's a hardcore group of Republicans, particularly in the House as well as in the party, who don't want any government, including disaster relief. They don't care what it is. They just as soon shut the whole thing down, go over the cliff, no disaster relief.
Do you really believe that, Jim? What if the hurricane had hit West Palm Beach? I have a feeling that even Alan West would line up.
Actions speak louder than words. This has been their consistent thing for the last 8 or 10 years. And it's not geography. It's just happened to be that there aren't any Republicans in the Northeast to speak of. This is a nationwide party issue. They've basically taken over the Republican Party, which I think you'll see, you know, more a narrower and narrower base for the Republican Party.
We'll see here. I mean, there were some Republicans in the Northeast hollering pretty loudly this week, Robert.
I mean, you can make the argument that Republicans are against all the spending, and that's a fair argument to make in some respects. But about this specific situation, about the Sandy vote, what I think really happened on a political level was that Speaker Boehner brought his fiscal cliff deal to the floor, and Eric Cantor, the majority leader, and Kevin McCarthy, the whip from California, they voted against the deal.
Yeah.
And Boehner was extremely angry, from what I hear from inside sources, about his number two and three deputies going against him on one of the biggest votes of the year.
Even in the last hour, they wouldn't put their shoulder next to his.
And so he wasn't ready, and Cantor was the one who was really shepherding this Sandy relief bill. Boehner wasn't exactly ready at late night to bring something to the floor to benefit Cantor, to help out Cantor right after Cantor and McCarthy had gone against him.
Let's hear a little perspective from overseas here, from Germany, Waltrup, Germany. Joham is calling. Joham, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
You asked a question earlier in the program, who won in this fiscal cliff, I would call it disaster negotiation.
Okay.
And I believe America lost.
Why?
Nobody won. If you look at it from the outside, and you remember from the election and from the campaign talk about American leadership and American exceptionalism, this was exceptionally sad. And I'm not saying that out of glee.
Because it was messy, because it was last minute, because it was so riven with dissension. Why, Joham?
Because it was no solution. I mean, there was an old saying, old German saying, which translated about like, the mountain went into labor and gave birth to a mouse.
So what, the world's waiting to see the U.S. really get its house in order, and you don't see it in this week's vote?
Absolutely not. And the weeks before.
Yeah. There's a lot of talk about this. Joham, I appreciate your call. Glad you're listening in Germany. I mean, Jack, the whole world is watching here, and you do have a little feeling of that, you know, Wile E. Coyote out off the cliff in terms of national standing, national prestige, about what we can afford, about our ambitions and other nations' expectations and assessment of us.
Yes, and increasingly the sense when a foreign policy crisis arises, we can't afford it. We can't do that. That there's a sort of budgetary limit to what the American government can undertake. And frankly, for the future of American foreign policy, that might be a good thing. But, you know, a mouse, I'm not so sure. I mean, the earned income tax credit, which kept something like 20 millions of people out of poverty over the last recession. That's been signed up, recommitted for another 5 years. Child tax credit, unemployment insurance for 2 million Americans, tremendously stimulative, $48 billion in economic activity, according to Moody's, 300,000 jobs created. Those are big achievements, and they're, if you will, moral achievements. I think the president deserves credit for essentially saying, I am not, you know, people like Paul Krugman were saying, go over the cliff if you have to. And the president was saying, if I go over the cliff, those folks who need the unemployment insurance aren't going to get it. I'm not going to do that. I think he acted in a principled way.
Moral achievements, maybe so. The rest of the world may be looking for more than that. Barbara in Pawtucket, Rhode Island. Barbara, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm calling to ask if all the representatives in Congress and the Senate are willing, due to their deep concern of our country, the health of our country,
yes,
are willing to stand up and take cuts in all their entitlements.
But that would amount to, you know, 5 cents in the big picture. I mean, maybe that would introduce them to the reality of a lot of Americans in recent years.
Well, it might do a lot for the psychology of the people who are, you know, anticipating what's happening to them.
Yeah, yeah. So feel the pain in Congress. Maybe that would get things going. It's a lot of money we're talking about here. Barbara, I appreciate your call. One more, Mike in Camden, Tennessee. Mike, you're on.
Thank you for taking my call.
Good to have you.
Look, I've been listening very quietly to your phone calls coming in.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody is talking about the past. The past is over. We need to talk about the future.
And what do you see out there, Mike?
My perspective is, not like a previous caller, that Obama is going to be looking for a reason to increase taxes. Obama will not increase taxes, nor will he decrease taxes on the bottom 47%. He will not increase taxes on the top 2%, because I think things are going to work out. Now, here's where we need to look at for the future.
Okay.
Number one is getting our tax code into perspective. There are still 20 corporations in the United States who pay zero tax because of loopholes in the tax regulations. That needs to be changed. And again, people have to have the right perspective. In 1941, the marginal tax rate on a progressive tax system, believe it or not, it was 91%.
Mike, I hear you there. You know, this idea of getting it all together is awfully attractive. I mean, Annie Lowry, instead of this piecemeal last-minute negotiation, you know, people dream of a scenario in which Congress sat down with the White House and put the country on a tax and spending footing that would really position us for the future, as Mike says, in strength, a kind of rational basis for going forward. I mean, is that just a dream? Is it just politics, tooth and nail? Is that any way to set us up for being strong in this century?
Well, I think that at some point, Congress can't keep on spending more than they're taking in tax revenue, right? At some point, we're not going to be able to do that. But I think if you're kind of making the optimistic case for the deal that they just struck, maybe they bought us a couple years to deal with the problem, and the problem remains long term. Our borrowing costs remain really low, and it's just that they're going to have to get to it at some point. And so they keep on kind of putting a gun against their own heads in order to sort of tackle the big issues. I do think that one thing that the caller mentioned that's right is that there's a lot of potential to improve the economy through tax reform. The tax code is really inefficient. It's really, really inefficient. The problem is that that's going to be a pretty politically painful process. I think if you go back to the 86 reform that was really, really big, that took years to put in place, and that was revenue neutral. They didn't actually raise any money with it. And so I think that probably there's going to be some process that's started to start cleaning up the code, but I think that's going to be very politically difficult. And I think that you're going to see just sort of more peaceful efforts over time. The other thing I noticed that we haven't talked about some other things that they could be doing that might be good for the economy or just good generally, you know, bills like immigration reform is something that Obama wants to work on, which has a potential growth benefit and some other things like that. So, you know, I think it'll be interesting to see how next year or when they have to deal with the sequester, when they have to deal with the debt ceiling, they actually start tackling those tax issues again.
Next year, which is now this year. Hannah writes to us,
the
barbecue recovery continues low and slow. Unemployment rate held at 7.8%. At least we're not going backward. What about these numbers, Annie, when it comes to the economy and how we're doing?
this just kind of underscores that the economy probably didn't get too much worse because of the debt ceiling debacle, although we're going to have to wait to see revisions. This is very much what we've been seeing for like the last, you know, not even the last 6 months, but maybe even the last year. The economy is not growing great, but it's growing just fine. And so there's some good things to look forward to in 2013. Housing is turning around, which is a huge part of our economy. And if we're building a lot more houses, apartment complexes, commercial buildings, that hires a lot of people, which is going to be good for employment.
Robert Costa,
so I think that's the big story to look for.
Robert Costa, trench warfare, more of it, Americans' hearts in their throats in the weeks ahead, or something else coming up?
Get ready for more trench warfare. There's no doubt about it. Because this sequester delay, the part of the deal in the Senate between McConnell and Biden was to delay the sequester, the scheduled defense cuts, for 2 months. And that will coincide with the debt ceiling. And that's going to be another Republican showdown. And you already have so many Republicans coming out and saying they want to have brinksmanship, a showdown on the debt ceiling. Ted Cruz, for instance, the new senator from Texas, a Tea Party favorite, he said yesterday that a government shutdown should be on the table. I expect to hear a lot more of this in the coming weeks and months. And one of the most important things to watch is how to Boehner and McConnell respond to this kind of talk. Is a government shutdown really on the table? Are Republicans going to push?
Hey, Jack Beatty, Al Gore looks like he made $100 million over this week on selling Current TV to Al Jazeera. How about you this week, Jack?
No, I didn't do so well. But on the other hand, I'm not as hard to find on the dial as Current TV.
Yeah, right. You're right here, and we're glad for it. Wow. What a deal. We'll see what flows on that channel. Robert Costa with National Review, welcome. It's great to have you today. Come back soon. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Annie Lowry with the New York Times. Great to have you as well, Annie. Please see you soon.
Thank you so much.
Jack, have a great year.
Thank you.
Here we go. 2013. This is On Point.